You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
Welcome back.
Hi, my name's Dave.
This is segment three, episode 36 of Security Jabber. I'm Matt Thompson.
I'm Dave Glenn.
Awesome. And then also we have
Jason Brown,
Chris Burrows,
Frank Cass,
Don Sarnecki,
and our beautiful and talented
Jess.
Awesome.
Who's that girl?
Jess.
So we spent the earlier segments talking, covered a couple different stories. Women in IT security was in segment one. And then last segment we talked about some of the gaps and challenges that we see in language and in different ways of going and monitoring employees. So in this segment, we're going to talk about new trends in cybersecurity and see if Dave can continue to distract me. Yeah. It's all jacked up a Mountain Dew or something.
Brains. So what are we talking about? Changes in cybersecurity landscape. What's new in cybersecurity? Before we read anything of this article, what do you guys think is new in cybersecurity? Don, what's new in cybersecurity?
Oh, man, all of the things. It's been a hot minute since I've been in the security sector, so glad to be back, but...
Thanks.
You know?
That was really
insightful.
Pithy.
I know.
What about you, Frank?
Nothing's new. Same attacks still work. Vulnerabilities that were disclosed a decade ago still exist on internal corporate networks.
And we're still talking about endpoints. Christopher?
Human is the weakest link, baby, all the time. It hasn't changed. I think we're getting better at training them. I think boards actually are taking notice, so that's new.
Yeah.
As we stated in the first segment, the articles that we talked about were non-tech articles,
mm-hmm.
which is great to see from our standpoint because the more
business visibility.
The more they see it, the more we can help them.
Good.
I've created a security appliance that we're moving closer to bringing to the public. That will solve all the problems those guys just discussed.
All the problems of the free world and hunger forever?
I don't know about those things, but the security problem, sure.
Nice. I like it.
I think for me, what I've noticed over the last couple of months I think is really interesting is how we're seeing blockchain, different types of delivery, and instead of trying to encrypt data or steal data, they're just trying to use up resources. And so they're going in and putting different type of crypto miners on those systems. Now, I think those attacks are going to pivot at some point and they are going to lock them down. But I think it's really unique in that using computer resources is starting to become a viable cyber crime.
Cyber
poaching. Yeah, exactly. Resource farming and the ability to... is that better? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
I think the mic is inside
thing on?
Of him.
Oh, sorry. Different show.
Whose house?
Nice. All right. So listen, I think that one of the interesting things that we're running into now is this whole idea of distributed computing. People have always rented out botnets and stuff like that for different types of attacks. I think more and more, you know, we're going to get to the point where this, you know, crowdsourced platforms for the ability to use someone else's resources to do the work, to do your work for you. What was the tool we talked about? There's a Monero tool or something like that we talked about it's actually a legitimate tool where people donated some of their time.
Well, that's Ethereum.
No, it wasn't Ethereum though. There was anyway.
Was it CoinHive?
CoinHive, that's what it was. CoinHive. I think we'll see more and more people start to, you know, we donated computer time for SETI years and years and years ago. I think you'll see more of this. So what? No, don't remember that. You're looking at me.
No, I remember all of that. I'm just interested to see where this is going.
I'm not sure where it's going. Stop. It's kind of interesting to watch this. Not only is there malicious intent on some of this stuff, but I think more and more, you know, you look at shared resources, you look at the fact that the delivery platforms it's becoming less relevant, and you know, content is what we care about, and we care less and less about the delivery platform. You've got this idea of shared computing that people are, you know, people are either stealing it or people are donating it. And I'm just interested to see what's going to happen as that continues to get more and more sophisticated. Can I go rent space, rent computing power from someone legitimately that's crowdsourced this, you know, what's happening with my desktop when I go to lunch? Can I use those processing cycles to do something different? Are organizations going to start using things like, you know, as boundaries get thinner and thinner, start using distributed resources of, you know, the idea. Remember the whole just a bunch of, the whole JBOD thing where you chain a bunch of disks together and use that space. I'm just wondering if this whole idea of shared computing, if we're coming to a point in the cycle where people are going to start using those unused resources either legitimately or illegitimately. You look at what's happening with the whole crypto mining thing and the stealing of resources. What's the practical application of being able to distribute that distributed computing and being able to use that, leverage that for good? Maybe think about our network. Think about even a company of any size and being able to leverage some of that computing power. Do you think there's a legitimate use for that? I mean, people are doing it maliciously. What about shared resources for an organization for good? Is that on the horizon? Can you see something like that?
Well, I think that's really where all of this stuff started. So you talked about SETI. There was the Folding at Home project was a big one, and I hope still is. But those were around long before you started seeing crypto viruses and these different crypto mining pieces of software in general. The Folding at Home project was fantastic.
I have to find that.
I think what we continue to talk about show after show after show, especially in this kind of cryptocurrency world that we're in, is that these things just adapt. In general, cartels just adapt. Once something's not working for them in the most efficient manner anymore, they come up with a new angle. So we had previously talked about video games being free, and you know, you to be able to play have to let your crypto, you know, mining video card run for X amount of time before you get X amount of time to play. You know, we talked about that as probably being on the horizon. We've talked about how it's almost certainly on the horizon that these crypto style viruses that hit machines will come then with a payload that will eventually self decrypt your machine once it's done Bitcoin mining. So let's say you get hit, it encrypts all your stuff and it runs as a crypto mining rig for 1 week. And then when it's done, it unencrypts your stuff. You're probably going to see that because then it gives people an incentive. I don't actually have to pay them. I just have to let them soak up the power in my house or my business. And they actually come back, you know, and have their stuff. So you're going to see it. It's a natural progression.
Kinder, gentler, malicious attackers.
It's an easier way for them to monetize, I think, is really what it boils down to. Especially, you know, you see a lot of these South American and other types of cartels around the world doing this sort of stuff more often. So I think you're just going to continue to keep seeing them adapt in ways that are both predictable and unpredictable in some ways.
I think you answered my question. I'm not, my question was really long and sort of,
the answer was yes.
42.
Does anybody else get nervous when Jason starts talking about, well, if I was a bad guy, this is the way I would do it? He's got like he goes back. I just imagine he's got like this big chair and he has evil ideas and he puts them up on the board. And like, if I was a bad guy.
You know, Jason's not really here. This is his avatar. He's actually sitting at one of his avatars.
Have you been in my office and seen the whiteboards? It's amazing.
So
you can get lost in there.
So a couple of different things in here. Things that they're different types of attacks that they see happening in cybersecurity or trends. First is that malware is becoming self-propagating. So it used to be if you wanted to deliver a virus, you had to click on something. The user had to do something. Now, once the viruses are getting into the network, some of them are able to self-propagate and move laterally through the network. So that's a new type of attack vector. And if that makes things really hard as security practitioners. How are you guys? What kind of controls and what types of methods are we putting in place to help protect against that?
Port isolation, obviously.
Anything else?
Crickets?
I guess first I would say is that...
I don't even know what that means. What's port isolation? What are you talking
about?
The
most important thing that you can do to stop lateral movement is to implement port isolation in your networks, period. What that does is it isolates the machines that shouldn't be talking to each other from each other in the first place. So your broadcast traffic will still work. You'll be able to surf the webs and do all of that wonderful stuff, but patent accounting no longer has direct access to other computers on that same switch. So let's say Pat is C-level Jane's secretary. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for her to be able to access that particular machine. So moving laterally shouldn't be an exploitable attack in that particular switch, simply because port isolation is in play.
What in that scenario, why would we ever not have port isolation?
Just because it's an afterthought for most people.
Okay.
They didn't put it into play at the beginning.
Because basically what you're saying is if it's non-specific directed traffic, you prevent that from happening. And right, because if you've mapped a share, if you're communicating via an approved protocol like SMTP or FTP or anything like that, you let the legitimate traffic flow, and then you stop the rest of the traffic. So in essence, completely stopping lateral movement, is that a thing?
Yeah, I mean, it can be. When you're talking to your network architect and your operations goons, they should be able to have a good discussion about who should have access to who. When you turn on port isolation, you should be able to have a good discussion. So let's say hypothetically, everybody needs to be able to access via RDP the training room computers. Mm. That's a very easy thing from a port isolation to turn on or off. So you say that these physical ports are isolated and these physical ports are not isolated. You can say all of these isolated ports are allowed to talk to these non-isolated ports, and you're done. That will stop over 90%, probably close to 98-99% of your attacks from a lateral movement perspective.
Is that one of the top 20 critical controls out there? Segmenting your network, making sure it's not just entirely flat, that every port is open to every workstation, every server, that anybody can talk to anybody. Is there a specific control that addresses that?
Off the top of my head, I'm sure there is, but I don't know what number it would be on the top 20.
Yeah.
So.
It's hard to design too, because quite honestly, people have networks and they're working. So the amount of money it's going to cost to re-engineer everything is tough. And then what I found too is vendors really don't understand what all the ports that need to open. So when a vendor comes in to install a product, they ask for admin. We say no. And we go through this rigmarole of, I'm going to give you this, and I'm going to tell me the five things that you need open. It's the least privileged model. And if we went through the least privileged model, we'd do a lot better, but we don't. Because it's a lot harder.
Yeah, the trick is building it right from the start, the get-go, making sure that everything is locked down from the beginning.
The saving grace is a lot of people going to the cloud. Now you have a clean sheet of paper to work it off of. So you can set up access control lists. You can set up software-defined networks. You can set up firewalls. You can set up all these things now that you could never really could do with your soft, gooey middle that you have in your data center, because that's what it is, really.
So what do you think about technologies like Forescout and the network visibility stuff that's starting to? Do you guys know anything about Forescout and technologies like that?
All of these things. I mean, always come back to the same conversation: layers of the onion. These are all incredibly important pieces. If you do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and make yourself an undesirable target, they typically will move on to the easier targets in general. There's nothing that's foolproof, nothing at all. Frank can tell you this all day long. In general, it's just making yourself difficult at all levels if you can.
Yeah, these basic fundamental security controls too will stop some of these exploit kits, which rely on these vulnerabilities, the low-hanging fruit. So just by having some of these controls in place, you can effectively stop yourself from being a victim of ransomware or an exploit.
Like what? What controls?
Like patching.
Okay.
Removing admin access.
Okay. What else? More easy buttons.
Training.
Okay.
Backups, because you're eventually going to get hit and you need to recover.
Right on. And that whole backup thing seems to be one of the easy buttons to solves everything, right?
Well, I mean, it comes back to doing all of these things right, though. So, I mean, if your backups are touchable by whatever, you know, the attacker is using. So we saw all those, I'm going to forget the major one that came out. When was that? About a year or so ago. We were helping everybody with it, but I can't think of the name of it.
WannaCry?
No, it was before that.
Locky.
Yeah. Everybody was getting hit with Locky, and that thing would go after your backups. Mm-hmm. So if you had a couple notable types of backup appliance, it would go and it would hit those. So you had to make sure that you had offline backups as well. If you didn't have offline backups, you were done. You were dead in the water.
I wonder what's I need to go back and look at the statistics in terms of how many people actually got deaded from that. I mean, you know, companies that actually lost everything because of those situations.
I think the statistic was 1 in 5 businesses close after a ransomware event.
Yeah, which is a big deal. It's a big deal nowadays because these weren't all tiny mom and pop shops either. There were some sizable organizations that ended up at least getting hit. You know, at least losing a lot of revenue, if not.
Yeah. In this story, they actually mentioned that was ransomware was not just for ransomware. It was the next kind of trend that they were stating. And there was one hospital group that said they basically budget for paying the ransom now because they know they're going to get hit so many times. But then we saw with NotPetya that essentially it looked like ransomware, but it was really there to do destruction. So it just wiped everything off the computer. So it wasn't a real ransomware attack. The other thing that they're talking about in this story is the way that adversaries are kind of stepping their game up and doing things like hiding in encrypted traffic. And then they're also saying basically by using the encryption, they can bypass a lot of stuff. And so now you need new tools to breed encrypted traffic that was generally trusted before.
Yeah, there's even a new malware sample that was just disclosed recently. I believe it was a campaign going on for roughly 6 or 7 years. I believe it was Kaspersky, too, that just released this information. But essentially, the malware itself hides in a virtual encrypted file system that you can't even see on the disk unless you're specifically looking for it. And even if you do find it, it's just an encrypted blob. So you wouldn't even know that it's malware to begin with.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about package deliverables now that that can run a Linux distro in your browser. Turning on and running Linux on your Windows 10 machines because your antivirus that's on that box isn't going to look at the Linux part. It's only going to look at the Windows part. These are all well-known things at this point, and they are occurring in just tremendous numbers.
So what is the gracious, I totally forgot my question now. Sorry. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, and when you look at the different ways that they're doing this, and the small business isn't going to probably be able to afford tools to safeguard themselves. So it goes back to what you guys were saying. You've got to have the plan in place and you've got to do things like backups because you're not going to be able to afford the high-end security tools to start doing sandboxing and honeypotting and then SSL decrypting and endpoint. It just becomes cost prohibitive at that point. But if they don't do backups and they don't have a response plan, then they are going to be one of those 1 in 5 companies.
Yeah. If you're doing the essentials, then they're going to move on, like Jason said. Make it easier or harder to hack yourself, so they'll move on to the next easiest target because all they have to do is go next door. They're not using the basic fundamental security controls because they don't know what to do because that's not their core business. They're not an IT shop. They make widgets or boxes. Mm-hmm. So they don't know any better. It's working today and it's going to keep working tomorrow until they get ransom and then they're going to address it. Unfortunately, that's the mantra.
So back to the containerization question for a second. When we talk about the ability to launch those browsers in a shell and we talk or in its own protected space, we've talked about this a couple of times about how, you know, it's really just the centralized computing conversation all over again. It's Citrix, it's RDP, it's what, you know, we've talked about this for years. What's different about that whole, like companies like Fireglass and that whole protected browser, you know, running a browser in its own container. What's different about that now as compared to like just what RDP did? That question's kind of to you, Jason, because everybody else is looking at me blankly.
Well, I mean, Fireglass is a really cool technology, just to kind of like define what it is. It's like having a virtual web browser that you would just connect to, and every single session is just kind of disposable. So if any kind of infection, drive-by download, whatever happened to occur, it's going to happen there, and it's not going to spread throughout your machine.
What can you interact between those and like a Word document? You can copy and paste from those, right? From the session? You don't have to?
That's a good question. I don't know. We have an expert, Todd Betsky, who's not here. You know,
it's a good thing I asked that question tonight then, huh?
Yeah, exactly, right? But in general, you know, those are the types of technologies that we need to be moving towards, you know, in just mass. We're not there yet. You know, these things come at a pretty hefty price tag. It's not new, though. These things are just simply not new. They've been around forever. We're just finding new creative ways to adapt old technologies to overcome particular problems that we have now. That's all. So having Linux distributions run in browsers is an old school thing.
Yeah.
Everybody used to do that for virtual computing back in the day. It was slow and cumbersome, but code has gotten faster, better. You know, Web 2.0 technologies are available. Everything from, you know, PHP, ASP, you name it, can handle these things today where you just couldn't in the past.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you see a mass migration to stuff like that? Do you think people are actually going to start using that? And what do you think the barriers are to getting there?
It's not a matter of what I think or not. It's more or less what I hope. Again, yeah. I hope we're moving in the right direction. But again, to you know all of the different points that have been made tonight, we continue to see, without question, most people just put in a minimal effort. A lot of times they're stuck with an infrastructure that they inherited. They don't have time, maintenance windows or otherwise, to make the appropriate changes. A lot of times they don't have the budgets. So we continue just to see over and over and over again this lack of moving in the right direction. But I hope, and I'm optimistic, that you know that will change eventually.
Yeah, as long as we can stay fat, dumb, and lazy sitting on our couch and nothing interfering with that. I want to just kind of go back to a couple of the things that it's talking about here. The threat vector of the Internet of Things, IoT devices, 60% of IoT devices are deployed by operational technology, not IT. Lots of that are unmonitored, creates backdoors to other systems. It's often using age technology. So we talked earlier in the first segment about a little bit about network segmentation, and then a little bit ago about that the whole idea of port isolation. From an IoT perspective, anybody got any comments? Frank, you've done some IoT pen testing and stuff like that. What do you guys think about actually protecting those IoT devices? What can people do proactively to make sure that those devices are protected?
I guess one simple thing you can do if you have the capability of doing it is just restricting what websites and what hosts those sort of devices can access. So if your refrigerator, your Samsung refrigerator, only needs to go to Google or Twitter to do those, you know, its functions for the smart screen, whitelist Google and Twitter and block everything else.
So denial, unless really we're kind of flipping around on IoT devices to denial unless they specifically allow, instead of allow all unless they specifically deny, which has kind of been our approach to security for some time, is because we're so concerned about making sure that, as you said earlier, lots of times people don't know what ports to open, so they open them all. They just punch a big hole in it.
I think the challenge here is that the people deploying it aren't IT people. So there's, you know, when they're after, so operational IT people go out and they put, you know, different IoT devices all over many different networks and put all this stuff up and, hey, we're great. This is working better. And then someone like Frank shows up and, you know, does a pen test and go, hey, all these devices have a problem. Now they have, from an organizational and people in process, they don't have a way for IT to have access to these devices. They got to go back and kind of rewrite everything and share between operational and your IT security team. We did a number of workshops the last couple of weeks, and that's came up a couple of times where the patching, they couldn't do they couldn't do patching because IT or operations own patching and not security. And everybody's kind of in their own little buckets, if you will. And so there's known vulnerabilities, but there's just the paperwork's getting in the way of doing the right thing.
It's you know, it's, they just need to take some ownership of on the operations side. Patching is essential. I mean, who likes to go get their oil change in their car? I don't. I don't like to pay $50, but it's essential to keep your engine running.
This is true.
So, I mean, there's certain things you need to do for your job or for what, or for the tools that you use to do your job that are just mandatory because if you don't patch the IoT device, someone's going to find out it's not patched and take advantage of it.
Well, a lot of times too, IoT devices, they tend to be made very cheaply and they get made in foreign countries that may or may not, you know, embed bad software right in the IoT device out of the box.
So you have to build that in the cost of doing business. You either rip and replace those devices or you ride it and buy cyber insurance and deal with the ramifications, or you use your basic things, patch, test, train. I mean, that's
repeat.
There's a cost. So which cost do you want to pay? This side, that side, or the other? You're going to pay one way or the other.
I think the irony here, too, is a lot of times IoT devices are put in place so you can increase profit. You can make things more productive. You can get more data and streamline your operations. But then if they get hit by a cyber attack, your production line's down. So,
or worse, even better, to improve security.
Yeah.
You get cameras to improve your security and they're hacked.
Right. Exactly. Well, guys, would you like to tell? Would you like to share that with us before we?
The soup to nuts is we were hitting at CBI, one of the world's largest telcos, and at one point I was using their security system to film one of the C-levels who was on a copier. Copying stuff while I was actually stealing those documents off the copier while he was doing it. It went into a bunch of other IoT stuff. So like their door locks and everything. I had all of that. He was trying to leave the facility. I had the little like door thing that
Seriously?
Yeah, that's so awesome. He kept trying to drive and I would set it back down and it was great. I still had it all on like all the cameras. It was fantastic. It was a lot of fun.
That's so fun. That, you know, that's what, when people ask what we do, I love talking about stuff like that because that's the fun stuff, right? So guys,
yeah, so you write the report,
right, and then there's that. So guys, this has been the world's most awkward evening in Security Jabber history. So appreciate you all joining for this. Before we close here, intelligent words of advice, Matt, you got something for everybody?
Oh man!
So
right on the spot.
So there's
going to be drink before you podcast.
there's three questions. You can pick one of any of the above. Security recommendations. What you're watching on TV right now, or a good book or article you just read.
Let's see. Stuff I'm watching on TV. Survivor. The new season's back. And
Ghost Island.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good. So I like some of the character development on this one. I know it sounds weird.
How far in is it?
It's like 3 or 4 episodes. Okay. So
I haven't watched it in like 10 years.
Yeah, I can't believe I've been watching it for 10 years. Like my wife and I, we started watching it when we first got together, and it's going to be 12 years this summer. Wow. So yeah, it's amazing. You don't even remember the old shows. They're showing like clips from the old ones.
Richard Hatch.
Yeah. No one's ever going to forget that guy, okay?
Johnny Fairplay, who...
Oh, yeah.
True story, Steve and I met him in Park City, and he's a weird dude.
He looks like Sammy Hagar.
He does. Like a little skinny, twiggy.
Yeah, weird guy.
Sammy Hagar. All right, so Survivor. Jason, you got anything? Words of wisdom, stuff you're watching?
Never, man. I mean, you've met me, right? I don't have anything to say. Whatever.
Yeah.
About anything.
All right, moving on. Just kidding. What do you got, Jason?
This month, Ready Player One, the movie comes out.
Yeah, baby.
Very excited.
What do you think? I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. Although in the trailer, they've already screwed up the story, but...
Well, we know that the story doesn't anywhere... It's nowhere close to the same thing. So the book was amazing. The movie, I think, is going to be amazing.
If you don't put the two together.
They made the movie into hackers, the movie, essentially. So they've got a group of kids now that are, like, together from the beginning. It takes away the whole love affair between the important characters and such.
The isolation was such an important part of that story, and I feel like they
removed
ruined it. Yeah,
all just threw it out.
Which by the way, that is my favorite book of all time. But I made the mistake of telling a friend of ours that before she went on a cruise. And it's a woman that grew up in the '80s, but wasn't a tech savvy person. And she loved the book, but it wasn't her favorite book of all time. So I oversold it, I think.
It's my favorite book of all time, yeah. For sure. Yeah. I didn't know about it until I started working at CBI and somebody else was reading it.
Right on.
And they just kept telling me, like, this is so amazing. And yeah. I finally caved and got it. And I've probably read it in the last 2 years 5 times. So that's like awesome. Not even a joke.
I'm trying hard not to reread it until after I see the movie because I want the movie to be fun. And the last time – this is awful, but I went and saw – this is terrible. I can't even believe that I'm admitting this. I went and saw Wrinkle in Time. It was god awful. I loved Madeleine L'Engle, and Madeleine L'Engle and C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were authors that I've read these books with my kids. Peter Jackson did a great job with Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit. I think Disney did a good job with the Narnia books. Wrinkle in Time was awful. Big Oprah scares me. Anyway,
we should start our own podcast for just bashing movies.
Bashing movies.
Yeah.
Ready Player One's going to be pretty fantastic.
Is bashingmovies.com available?
Bashing movies. I don't know. Probably not. .com.
You'd always typo squat it.
Yeah. Chris Bros.
So my latest book is called Traction.
Nice.
Solid book.
Great book.
read Rocket Fuel when you get a chance. That's a condensed version of it. It tells the story. Traction's the process. Rocket Fuel is the story. So anyway,
go ahead. And one more word of advice. So with daylight savings time, you know,
it's yeah.
pretty brutal for some people. But either use that extra time of daylight to do some exercise or go mentor somebody, because nice. Both of them are good for you.
Great.
That's great. Thank you, Frank. You got anything?
Yeah, I've been reading the 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss.
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, about efficiency and managing your schedule, making more time to do things.
I'd only work 4 hours.
Not necessarily, but...
Can I read it when you're done?
Awesome. Sure. Read...
I'd like to get under 80 hours.
Yes, me too. That would be heaven. Read Tribe of Mentors by same guy. It's segments of his podcast where he talks about health and spirituality and success, and they're just he takes all the best stuff from his podcasts and gives you words of wisdom. It's really good.
Cool, check it out.
Yeah,
why do I feel like he came in tonight prepared to have like a counter book for every book? Like he knew what he was going to do.
I'm sorry.
So the great intellectual.
I'm not trying to be a know-it-all. I just you guys are bringing up stuff that's passionate to me for me.
SMRT.
Stop, Donathan. What do you got?
What I have is
love is what I got. Sorry.
Just to be grateful. I start my day off every morning with about 10 minutes of meditation and 3 things that I'm grateful for. So today I'm pretty sure it was blow dryers, fresh cut grass, and the ability to have working legs.
Awesome.
So just as a way to really, really great way to start off your day. Yeah. Oh, I also read recently an article about a rescue shelter that in the kennels, they are taking old chairs from donations in the Salvation Army where the dogs can actually curl up so they are more likely to be adopted.
Nice.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I saw a picture of that sitting in the chair.
Yeah, so great. Cool. Makes me so happy.
That's really cool.
Let's get those little puppers really cool. adopted.
I would mention.
I'm not going to lie. It sounded like you were going to say earlier, like, I wake up every morning and have a mimosa is where I thought you were going to say.
Oh.
I was like, yes.
In a perfect world, yeah, the answer to that is yes.
Some beach, somewhere. Jess, what do you got? Nothing?
No.
All right.
That's why she's the number one.
Be nice
one,
to people. That's it.
There you go.
Be nice to people. So, man, that just escaped my brain.
Where to find
Oh, this? Yeah. I remember now. Watch the season of American Idol. Jen Linkowski, a friend of ours, is on it. And I think she's going to do, I think she's going to do well. I will post a video of my son doing a song with her I wrote and arranged the song and my son played it for her, and she's got this amazing voice that, and they didn't do it for any performance or anything. They were just playing and she's got an amazing voice. And I think Jen Linkowski is one to watch. She's from Oxford, Orion area. And the season of American Idol is going to be fun.
Look at that.
That's what I got. So, guys, where can you find us, Matt?
SecurityJabber.com.
.com.
And then on Twitter, at SecurityJabber. And then finally, Facebook.com/SecJabber.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night, and appreciate you tuning in. Take care.